Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year information podcast. I'm Brett Winton. We've got a great show for you today. Kathy Wood is going to join our CIO, CEO, fearless leader, along with the co-founder, CEO, as well as the director of business development for Layer Zero, which is an interoperable function between blockchains. It basically allows you to easily transfer one asset from one blockchain to another. So in a world in which the number of blockchains is seemingly exploding, and in a world in which stablecoins are spreading across the world like wildfire, Layer Zero is well positioned. So stay tuned to see how Brian Pellegrino thinks about the future of blockchains and interoperability. At a high level, at ARK, we think that stablecoins will scale to on the order of $5 trillion in value by, or two to five, by 2030. And so it's clear that these are useful instruments for people to use all over the world. And Layer Zero plays an interesting and important role in making them useful. So I hope you learn a lot and enjoy the conversation. From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. We have a great show for you today. We have our fearless leader, Kathy Wood, with us. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Great, Brett. How are you?
And we have Brian Pellegrino and Simon Baksis. I hope I pronounced your last name right. Both from Layer Zero. Layer Zero is, think of it as like the communications layer that can stitch together blockchains. That's my understanding of it. First of all, Brian, I just found out that you are the number one heads up, no limit poker player in the world for a while. How do you go from there to kind of startup land? Why aren't you still grinding at the poker table?
Sure. So it's a pretty circuitous path, but actually somehow it connects. So I grew up in rural New Hampshire, like a town of 900 people. I would say I was just like a nerd with a computer, right? That was really my childhood. Went to school for computer science, dropped out to play poker professionally, which I did for 8 years. Like Brett said, for the game that I played was one of the very best players in the world, kind of played the highest stakes in the world you could play. I did 80 countries during that time, so I was traveling everywhere. But then something very interesting happened, which is April 15th, 2011. I woke up one day, I sat down at my computer ready to get to work, and there was Department of Justice symbols on every single website that existed, and the online poker industry had been banned in the United States. So you woke up one day, and all of your money's locked up. Your career is gone. You have no access to anything, just with no heads up or anything from one moment to another. And funny enough, that is the moment that everybody in poker found Bitcoin. Bitcoin was the way that all of us moved money between the remaining sort of poker sites because all of the payment processors were now not available in the United States. So found Bitcoin very early in 2011, very much drawn to it, as you can imagine, for the ethos of it at the time, and realizing like, oh, hey, maybe something that is sort of censorship resistant and has, you're not going to wake up one day and is just going to disappear is interesting and attractive. So I found it then, started a company in 2011, sold it in 2013, saw DeepMind's Atari agent demo, which was like really amazing for the early days of reinforcement learning. Got really excited what we could do with that. I hadn't written code in about 8 years. So started writing code just for fun, building some models. Showed it to a friend who said, I have this like amazing group of MIT PhDs who have worked on something similar. Me being a college dropout, it's like fairly intimidating. I'm like, okay, great. I'll talk to them and start to talk to them. show them what I was building. And they said, oh, this is really amazing. We have somebody you should talk to. And I got on that phone call the next day, and that person was Billy Beane. So the founder of, you know, Moneyball, the GM of the Oakland A's. So I ended up selling the machine learning models I was building to a bunch of the pro baseball teams. Started another company in the Valley with first engineer out of A16Z, a couple guys at a Google, comma, got acquired 3 years later. And then did independent research for about a year and a half. Ended up having showing Noam Brown, who's at Facebook AI Research at the time. He's now the creator of the O1 and O3 models at OpenAI. Brilliant, brilliant guy. And he said, oh, this is really amazing what you guys have done. Like, you've got to publish this. Come publish this with me. And so we structured it. We published this academic research, which again, as a college dropout, was like very interesting. Full circle came around, and DeepMind, the one who inspired me and kind of got me into that side of the world, ended up citing our paper, which is very cool. But I had followed, you know, Bitcoin. I'd been mining in my garage in 2013, 2014. I've kind of lived kind of deeply in the industry. It wasn't till smart contracts, really, Ethereum and the advent of, hey, you can, you know, now it's programmable money. You can do something really interesting with it, that I really, really dove in fully. And then ever since then, I've been obsessed. I haven't been able to look away. We started Layer Zero 5 years ago. So me and two of my closest friends, we founded, you know, we've worked together for almost 20 years now, founded everything but one of those things in the past together. And so it's been an interesting journey, but it's been a blast. It's been amazing.
Yeah, let's track back to that 2011 moment where it's like, oh, Bitcoin, this is an uncensorable money. Surely we only need one of these things. And then you fast forward to today, where it seems like every week I read there's another layer one that's launching. There's, you know, 11 different rollups on every chain. It seems like there's so much complexity out there. What is your one, before you talk about layer zero, like, what is your read on the space and where we are in terms of institutional buy-in and adoption, and what that means for all of this proliferation of, call it, different theories of block space? Go on, Kathy.
Just one thing first. Let's introduce Simon. And
oh, yes.
Him.
Simon, please jump in, fly on the wall. Yeah.
I'm just flying the wall, supporting actor here. My story is far less interesting and maybe a bit shorter than Brian, so I'll keep it brief. But I'm originally, if you want to take it back to the roots, from Eastern Europe, from Lithuania. I was born and raised there and been in the States for about 16 years or so. Spent most of my career in tech. Before Layer Zero, I was at Google for about 7 years. 3.5 of those years I spent on the Google Cloud side, and then the latter half of the tenure there I spent co-founding and leading the crypto and digital asset efforts for Google and for Alphabet, which was a fun journey in itself, and we can talk about that later in terms of, I think the most common question I get there is, what is Google doing in crypto? So we can talk about about that a bit more. And then that's actually what led me to Layer Zero, is because we saw an amazing opportunity in, what was it, maybe 2022, when we first started talking to Brian and his co-founder Ryan on sort of the opportunity to potentially partner and further explore this technology that was Layer Zero and what it really meant for the industry, which is exactly what we did. And 12 months later, we announced the partnership between Layer Zero and Google when I was still on the Google end. We announced it at Token 2049 in Singapore at, you know, one of the bigger conferences there on stage. And Brian and I shared the stage and talked about it, and then ended up going to Formula One race there that weekend in Singapore, and maybe spent just a tad bit too much time together that weekend.
Bonded,
and now fast forward, I think tomorrow is going to be my 2 year anniversary at Layer Zero, so time is flying, and I'm sure we'll dig into to why and that made sense, etc. But that's the quick background.
Yeah, and I should say I met Simon at a Christie's tech conference. So art and tech converging. And just met kind of at the end of that conference, the dinner, and I asked him what he was doing. And, you know, I had heard of Layer Zero, but didn't know anything about it. But came back to the office, and our guy said, "Oh, Layer Zero, that's a great company. That's, you know, and so universal acclaim." And I and so that's how this all came about, wanting to learn more about Layer Zero. Can I just ask one question? Since you were going to Bitcoin, Brett, starting, you know, Peter Thiel, about a year ago, it seems now, declared that he thought that with BlackRock and all the institutional money moving into the space, that it was, you know, it was done with its heady days. And, you know, he seems to have lost some interest. What is your sense? And what is the sense of the community out there?
Yeah, I think this is an amazing question, by the way. I think there's two camps. And one is that Bitcoin's largest strength historically is that it just hasn't changed. It's predictable. You know exactly what you're going to get. It's not, there isn't risk there. It really is digital gold in its best possible form. And I think that has been amazing. But I think what you have seen is all the incredible properties and like the mathematical nature of it have drawn very large institutions. Now, I think the benefit is that a lot of the institutions, a lot of the mining pools are really broadly distributed. It is not just held in one place. It is not just a single jurisdiction. You still have this incredible, truly decentralized spread of both where it's held and, more interestingly, where it's mined. And so I think that has been really good. But I think Thiel's point and kind of the point of some of the industry is that, in a way, Bitcoin has lost a little bit of its cypherpunk edge. And I think that's sort of like the roots of this anti-establishment sort of like disrupting. And I give a speech on this maybe a year or two ago now. There's really almost parallel in that institutionally, nobody wanted this to happen at the very large. And, you know, now we spend a lot of our time with many of the largest financial institutions, and everybody has a strategy now. Everybody's thinking about it. Everybody's saying, what does this transition actually look like? And over the last decade, most of them, if they could have snapped their fingers and killed it, they absolutely would have, right? So like, the reason they're here and the reason this is happening is because it is strictly better technology, right? It's not because they wanted to. It's not because, you know, any side of that. It is purely because it is a better form of technology, and it has properties that enable things like Tether that were just not easily possible before. And so I think that adherence early is kind of what drew everybody to it. And then now I think the feeling for some is that there are too many compromises being made in the last mile that don't need to be made. People are at the table now because of what it is. And that if you morph it too much, it just becomes a replication of the existing system and not actually all of the beautiful and amazing and enabling things that sort of like it was in its early roots. And so I think it's like that is sort of the crisis of industry at the moment is how much compromise is too much at the tail end.
And what compromises are you talking about? Maybe I'm not up to date.
Yeah, but I mean, Brett was just talking about layer twos, right? And so one of the biggest complaints about layer twos historically is Ethereum, a really great, broad, decentralized, you know, does what it does very well, was really struggling to scale. Transactions were $100. You couldn't get nearly enough throughput. You're starting to get competed away by Solana and by others who are focused on speed. And so the solution was, we're going to make a bunch of layer twos. And the layer twos are a single sequencer, and they can scale to 10,000 transactions per second, maybe 100,000 transactions per second. And one day, there's a plan where it will inherit the security of Ethereum. It was like this beautiful dream is it will be exactly as secure as the underlying. But what has happened in practice is most of them have still have some multi-sig controls. They still have the ability to upgrade the underlying contract. There's all these reasons of why we've made these compromises along the way. There's places like L2Beat and others who sort of like monitor and challenge some of these things. But the point is that now ultimately the security of these tens of billions of dollars that exist on the layer twos right now at the moment in time largely come down to a small set of a multi-sig for these given properties. And there's a path to one day to that improving, but that is the type of compromise that people talk about is if everything is held in a single chain of a centralized party, you know, what does that actually look like for the world? Is that progress? Is the digital ledger enough if you don't have the decentralization of control or censorship resistance?
Well, it's like even just Ethereum rising or Solana rising are manifestations of that. You know, Bitcoin is kind of like at least a more pure kind of uncensorable chain than these other chains are and the things built on top of them are.
That is what I was getting at there. That is not what you meant. The compromises have not been in the Bitcoin world, right?
No, the only compromise in the Bitcoin world that is seen in the industry is the really diehard Bitcoiners are upset that we're even happy that BlackRock is at the table. You can have a sum. I think we should be happy, right? We should be, but yes.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a centralization vector in their minds, right? Is that right? Okay, that's good. Actually, that's a great distinction. It's distinguishing Bitcoin even more from everything else happening out there, right? Okay. Got it.
I mean, the way we categorize it technologically is like there's something happening in cryptocurrency land, which is basically Bitcoin and stablecoins, but then stablecoins are built on top of what's happening in smart contracting protocol land, which is its own thickety, thorny, like wilderness of kind of like bids for what the market is going to accept in terms of centralization versus throughput versus separate layers. And right now, it seems like, in part because capital markets are hungry for it, there is an explosion of kind of like attempts to do stuff there, including all of these competing layer ones. It's like Stripe has Tempo and Circle has Arc. And then there's Base on Coinbase. And so how do you, like, if I fast forward 5 years, am I going to have like 50 different competing layer ones and 3,000 different like roll-ups on top of them? What do you think is the kind of actual trajectory of the industry relative to where we are today in this kind of like foment?
Yeah. So I think it really comes in waves of technological advancement and then what the underlying business model is. So I think Ethereum was obviously like a really large technological advancement when it first came. And what you saw was a bunch of forks of Ethereum. If you look at everything from like the multiple years after, they were all just Ethereum clones. And so if Ethereum is this line, you had a bunch of things that sort of made trade-offs in any direction to any side, right? Less sequence or, you know, less nodes, a little bit faster, or trade-off on this part of the VM or whatever it might be. And most of that has gotten washed away by Ethereum scaling. Most of them have gone sort of by the wayward, right? There's a really strong, maybe economic incentive to try to compete at that layer, but most of them were the same thing. And you've seen the same with layer twos, right? And it was interesting looking at the value of the underlying layer twos. And if you stack rank the most valuable layer twos, it literally is almost just at the time that they launched. The ones who were first are still worth the most. And the ones who are last, with all the advancements and bells and whistles, are worth less, just like almost monotonically decreasing based on time.
So that's a network effect.
Yeah, I think it's network effect. And so I think you'll have these big jumps in technology. This is something Solana took a big risk, but it was like, we're going to be totally different. And they were like, totally different. And they have captured their own sort of segment of the market. So I think it's technological advancement and then like horizontal dispersion and then technical advancement and then horizontal dispersion. And so that's the way that I see it. So right now we're at the point of layer twos have come out. It is very easy to launch a new layer two to have your own chain. You have a bunch of organizations who are doing this now. The cost of doing that is almost free, right? It's very, very easy, especially with there's organizations will roll you out one in a day, right? It's very low lift. And yet, a lot of the value that is made on the chains, if you look at the value of Solana or Ethereum or any of these chains, a lot of it is the sequencing value. It's the value of block production itself, right? It's not actually, it used to be Ethereum made a ton of money on fees. Fees were really high. On Solana, fees are almost free, right? But Solana makes $1.5 billion in revenue a year right now. And that $1.5 billion is on priority fees and MEV, which is, you know, the value of the underlying transactions. And so once you become a big enough application or you're an institution, you say, well, I'm driving that traffic. Maybe I should own, you know, that if that's the valuable piece. And so I think that's what we're seeing now. I think we're seeing this really wide horizontal dispersion. I think it will likely. And so my personal view, and again, we're at layer zero, we're happy either way, right? We're on all of these things. We're connecting them all. It's great. And, you know, I have no
dog
in the race of wanting it to be less. Yeah.
Well, no, you do have a dog in the race. You'd rather there be a million blockchains so you can connect them all together. And so you can be like essentially the bridge function between them all, right?
Even at three or four, you know, you get really strong effects of just making it totally seamless in the background of those few. And you just have so many more messages being sent, right? You don't need a million telcos or structures of kind of where the underlying is laid. But I don't think you will have, you know, I don't think this will run forever. I think you will have some reconsolidation back.
Yeah, yeah, Simon.
That's kind of, yeah, I was going to say, that's, it's always what I say when people have sort of that view, which is, you know, the more the merrier. And I think for us, like, right, as long as there's two, we have a business, right? All we need is two. But I think also, you know, talking about the sort of the proliferation of all these chains and how many there will be, I think there's phases that are driven by different motivational factors. So I think Brian talked about the first one, which is sort of creating something different, right? Maybe better, maybe doing things in a bit of a different way. I think what we're starting to see with things like Tempo or Hood Chain from Robinhood, right, is sort of that second phase of motivation, which is, well, wait, I have the distribution, I have the users, I'm going to monetize my own users and that mm-hmm, distribution, mm-hmm. right? And maybe I'll create things a bit unique for my user base. And then there's sort of that third phase that we're seeing more and more of now, which is kind of a repeat of maybe 2017, 2018, 2019, which is the third motivation for this third phase is, well, I'm a institution. I need, you know, privacy. I need to lock this down. I need to kind of have it within my own four walls. So I will run my own thing. And if and only if I want to and decide to, I'll connect to the public world, which is, you know, via layer zero, right? But it's like different motivational factors.
I think I've had the argument / debate about private blockchains, like, you know, over three cycles, like a million yeah. times. Aren't we kind of coming back to that again, where it's kind of like JPM is like, well, I want to do my own thing. I'm not going to, you know, and then you're resolved to the question of like, well, why aren't you just have this in a database? Why are we pretending here, right? Like, is there a reason that would be different?
Yeah, another question. So I remember in the very early days, take Arc, the Circles Arc. I remember R2. Do you remember R2? It might have been two. Yeah, R2. And it was the same thing, financial institutions, way before its time, to be sure, from a technology point of view. And they didn't trust each other. It fell apart. But financial institutions, like banks in particular, with credit cards and Zelle, have been able to work together. Is your bet they will be able to again here in the ARC ecosystem, ARC?
We are, to Brett's point, kind of coming back to a little bit of that again, right? It was like, well, you know, private only, then that didn't really work out. And if you look at things like R3 Corda, right? R3 Corda ended up not too long ago committing to Solana and moving most of their consensus to the Solana ecosystem, which is pretty fascinating. In fact, mm-hmm. I was just at dinner with one of R3 people talking about that last night. And I think then you have folks like BlackRock saying, well, you know, we embrace the public chain world. Right, very publicly they've stated that, but yet there are still a bunch of financial institutions and banks, et cetera, that want some level of control. And I think there's some sort of middle ground there between kind of having a complete walled garden that is basically analogous to a database, Brett, I think to your point, versus sort of, you know, some sort of permissioned ledger that can connect to the public world, right? Or maybe having a subset that's private. Within a public chain world, and I think we'll see sort of various iterations of that. I don't think we fully go back to like everyone's just going to run like a Basu instance, you know, within their like crowd infrastructure. But there will be more variations of that again.
I think it would help our audience if one, maybe Brian, you could describe how does it impact the user if I have assets on one chain and I want to do something on another chain. Can you give like a tangible example of like what that actually means without layer zero? Like, what do we mean by all this stuff? Like, I use Robinhood. So what do I care if I'm on the Robinhood chain versus not? And how does it impact me?
Oh boy, without layer zero, it's going to be pretty grim, but I can paint the picture for you. So, I mean, really the big problem is there's twofold. One, back before it was very hard for asset issuers to natively go to all of these things. And so you might have one chain. And even if you're just talking USDC only, you would have like 8 to 10 different wrapped versions of USDC. You wouldn't even have you'd have ZUSDC and HUSDC and AUSDC, or all these different crazy versions, none of them which work to each other, all of which had fees to get between each other. So maybe Ethereum was paired versus ZUSDC, and if Bitcoin was paired against HUSDC. And so to actually go between them, you had to make an extra hop and pay another 30 bips in the swap, just this underlying. So cost, friction, pain for the users. That's all just within a single ecosystem of the asset issuer side. Then for the user, if you're on Ethereum and you want to go to Solana, this is what the process used to look like. He used to say, all right, I'm gonna somehow initiate a bridge. So I'm gonna lock some money on Ethereum and I'm gonna expect to get some money on Solana. But I don't have any Sol in my wallet and I need Sol to be able to actually claim my transaction on the other side. So how do I get it? Now you'd have to go to a centralized exchange or some external third party, somehow get the Sol, put it into your wallet on Solana so that you could then claim the thing that you were getting. And then somehow you'd end up with like ZUSDC, again, some random version of the thing that you didn't even want. And then you might be able to go about your day. And so really it is every environment you can think of as an entirely different world. Imagine walking from, Bank of America down to Wells Fargo, like your account isn't there, your information isn't there, you can't do anything. You have your bank card, you have all of your stuff, but there's no ability for you to actually enact. And that was effectively what was happening before. You didn't have the underlying currency or gas to be able to interact on the chain. It was a totally different walled garden environment. And so nothing was seamless, both for the asset issuer or for the users. So in a post layer zero world, you click a single time. You burn your asset on chain A, the real canonical asset directly from the asset issuer. They send a message to the destination chain that so it gets verified on chain. They have made this attestation that says, hey, all of our risk controls are met in that there's not more global supply than there should be, all of the things that they need to do. It gets minted directly on the other chain. You never see the gas of either one. It is all fully abstracted away. You just click once, you sign once, and you don't think about it all ever again. So both for the asset issuer and the user, that's obviously the long-term vision, is all of this stuff is just completely, completely in the background and fully abstracted.
And how did you jockey into this position? It's a great position. And can you talk a little bit about the competitive dynamics? This certainly is a winner take most. Has to be. But there's also jockeying. We're still at early days, right? There's jockeying into position, different competitive dynamics. So how did you get into this position? And congratulations. And a little bit about the competitive dynamics.
So I would say, actually, we're not trying to start a business. We were driven by the problem itself. We had, we were playing around on Ethereum. Smart contracts were there. Binance Smart Chain had just launched. And I'd seen a lot of chains come and go. They had all launched. Nobody really used them. They were just kind of there, little pieces of technology. But every day you're getting messages, more users than Ethereum, more volume than Ethereum. And you're going, hey, like something's happening. I don't know what it is, but something's happening here. There's something interesting. So we went and said, you have this environment now that's fast and cheap, but you might not trust it as much as Ethereum at the time. So let's treat it as entirely ephemeral, right? Just an execution environment, almost like a roll-up before a roll-up. And so we just built a toy thing for ourselves and said, we're going to do some computation here. We're going to bring the result back to Ethereum. And as we built that thing, we realized there was no way to actually trigger the event to get it back to Ethereum, to send the data here over there. And we were convinced it was Sol. Bridges existed. And we're like, okay, somebody has Sol. That's like, well, who should we use? And we looked at everything that existed and we were horrified. Like, we were like, I cannot believe anybody would use any of this stuff. This is insane. And, now 5 years later, we're, $5 billion in bridge hacks later. So like almost all that early stuff actually blew up. So directionally, we were right at the time. So then we started saying, hey, how can we build a better bridge? This is clearly something interesting. Like, how do we make it better? So we started to build none of this wrapped assets, all native assets, all guarantee of finality. We started to build the things that we thought would be a better bridge. And as we built that, we realized still we can't trigger the events on both chains. You add money here and you want to subtract it there. There's no communication layer to do that. And that was when it became very clear to us, hey, this is clearly the generalizable problem. And like this packet of moving information back and forth between these networks, it's like going back to pre-internet days when you have DARPA and Stanford and you have all these computing clusters, but no way to talk to each other, right? So that's when we really started to work on the generalizable piece. And it has been. I mean, we launched in 2022 and it was extremely, extremely competitive. I remember our first tens of thousands of dollars going over the network. And you kind of know everybody's using it and you see the first applications come and build. But just slowly over the last series of, three years now, a little over 3 years, we've really been able to work with just some amazing world-class partners. And so we've seen that grow to now we're doing almost $1 billion a day. So we did $38 billion last month, which is about about five times as much as Western Union does, about 2.5 times as much as Wise. You're doing a real economic value, real substantial amounts of assets being moved. And you have groups like, you know, USDT0, you have PayPal's PYUSD, you have BitGo, you have, you know, all of these more and more institutional assets that are coming, where it's, again, it's wrapped Bitcoin, it's PYUSD, it's all of these things. And you're starting to see more and more adoption being driven. And so today, I think we're probably, for the value transferred, amount of dollars moved over the network, we're at mid-80s to 90% market share. So it has definitely evolved into that way. But there was a time when we were clearly, you know, the underdog. It has been a slow process of going through that in a competitive environment. I think largely our edge in this competitive environment has been like, we have gone very, very deep with each of the partners. And I think a lot of people in this industry, more than most, love a great announcement. They love being able to put something else into the world and have a logo that says we're working with this group or we're doing this. And we told everybody early on, like, listen, a couple of things. We're not going to pay you any money to build on us, because that seems like a crazy relationship. So we're not going to pay you to build. And I don't care about a vapid marketing announcement. We want to build something that's actually going to be used in production. And so if you think that this is meaningfully going to move your business forward, we'll help you architect it. We will help you build it. And so we've gone on to build solutions that have been used, you know, to the tune of well over $100 billion for many of these key partners. And so we've helped co-develop and really built the early parts that have shown what you can do with the technology. And I think that more than anything really solidified us to some of these really incredible partners. And then everybody else has sort of seen that and sort of come forward with the technology.
Did they come to you because they were trying to solve a problem? They saw you really doing a good job at it. They came to you, or did you go to them?
So early on, very early on, it was definitely us coming to them. We're like, listen, you guys should have, you know, so much. Think about how much more business you could be doing if you were everywhere instead of in this one lonely place, right? And so early on, we were going to them and we were saying, hey, like, this stuff that you're doing now doesn't make sense. Of course, if you're an AUM-driven business, you want to capture more distribution and more users and go do that. Now it's very easy. We're now, you know, Simon can attest to even more. I mean, just how much inbound we get. And it's if you look at USDT0 is sort of the current shining example where Tether is arguably this incredible, one of the best businesses in the entire world. And they had, you know, $180 billion outstanding on Ethereum and Tron primarily, and a couple of these networks that are the, you know, historical USDT networks. And then USDT0 comes along and says, we're going to just extend this to the fringes, some of the networks that kind of weren't being used or you didn't have canonical USDT on. And just in 9 short months, just starting to touch those fringes and take some of the opportunities that weren't being taken prior, there's already almost $10 billion AUM just on that alone, which you're talking, you know, many $400+ million directly on the bottom line in terms of like net profit and tens of billions of dollars being moved monthly. And so now I think people have seen like, oh man, like This is no longer just maybe there's more. There is more. There's customers, there's demand. Again, $10 billion of AUM, I think, gets anybody excited. And so I think that example alone now is pulling everybody in and saying, oh, hey, we can't not be doing this.
I'd love to understand mechanically how it works a little better, but let me start by saying how I understand bridges, the kind, like the wormhole type bridge that got hacked worked. And you can then use that as like the, this is what layer zero actually does. So with the old school bridge, it would basically be like, I have money on Ethereum. I need to move over there. So I take the money and freeze it in an escrow account that we call a bridge, but it's really a prison for your money. And then I mint another asset that's attached to it and says, this asset on this new chain is backed by this money that's frozen in this prison. And then what happens as I'm messing around over here is somebody drills a hole in the prison and siphons all the money out of the prison. And so then the asset on the new chain looks back and is like, oh my gosh, there's nothing there anymore. And so the entire thing collapses. So that's my understanding of a bridge. Now, what does layer zero do and how does it work?
I love it. That is an almost perfect representation. So I think the first part about existing bridges is exactly that. It changes the relationship that the user has with risk. And so you're used to smart contracts. You're used to saying, if I go to Uniswap and I swap from asset A to asset B, I'm taking the risk of the Uniswap contracts, that they're sound, that they're not going to get hacked. but I just take the risk for the duration of that swap, for the one block. And as soon as that's done, the asset's in my custody. I have it. I never think about it again. I'm safe. I sleep like a baby. I forget about my wallet for 5 years. I come back, it's still there. The moment you introduce what you're describing, which is kind of this asset wrapping, locking, and escrow, the relationship really changes with the user because the user now carries that risk in perpetuity. As long as I have the asset in my account, I'm exposed to risk because if the bridge ever gets hacked, the messaging layer, if the underlying escrow, like you said, is a hole drilled in the bottom of it, all of a sudden this IOU that I have is no longer worth anything. It's not backed by anything, right? And so you're layering on this extra element of risk for the user that really changed the relationship the user has with the asset. So that is one bad thing. The second part is, everybody's approach to this early on was this approach of, it really sounds amazing. Really, you're selling a beautiful dream. I'm going to put this thing in the middle that is my own layer of security, my validators, my network, my whatever. Here's the thing. All of the rest of the world is going to route all of their information through that. And we'll just tell you, hey, this thing happened here, do this. This thing happened here, do this. And of course, if it works, it sounds amazing because literally all of the flow of everything in the world flows through your structure. Great. The downside is if that thing now lies, yeah, is broken, is hacked, it arbitrarily can just write information everywhere. Everyone just trusts it. It's a point of truth. And so now you're reducing the security of all of the networks of Ethereum, of all of this stuff, down to 21 validators or whatever this is, right? And so our approach is always, there's a couple of, one, you have global systemic risk within that structure. And the other is that you make the assumption that the little guys and the big guys both need the same thing, right? This thing has so much security and it costs so much to use. Maybe it's $1 per transaction. And your assumption is, a tiny 1 cent data transfer and a $100 million liquidation or transfer need the exact same security, the exact same parameters. So our approach was always as modular as could possibly be. It was, listen, we are the protocol. We are these immutable contracts that live here. These give you all of the guarantees that you want. We can't change them. You don't need to trust us in any way, shape, or form. You now, as the asset issuer, can come in, build your application, and define what you want your layer of security. Maybe you want it less for small transfers and more for big transfers. Or maybe if you look, how USDC has their own CCTP, and what they do is they have their own attestation server that sits outside and they say, I observed this and I'll authorize this, right? And that's what they do back and forth across the chains. Now, rather than having this wrapped contract that I own, that you have to trust that my contracts are good, you have the actual asset issuer itself, right? Wrapped Bitcoin by BitGo, PayPal's PYUSD with Paxos, where the asset issuer is seeing this thing burned. They're saying, I'm gonna create this attestation. I'm gonna say, yes, I saw it burn. Yes, it meets all of my risk criteria. The global supply is existing. I have the backing money here. I can confirm there's not more supply on any chain. And I don't want to be the only authorizing factor. I'm also going to use Google and X and Y and Z and sort of all these other parties to also authenticate this thing. And so it really was just that authentication layer can look like anything. It can be a zero knowledge proof that's constructed by the signatures of every validator on Ethereum. It can be a single attestation by the actual asset issuer themselves who have their own controls, which is how everything was done prior anyways, and the layer that you're already trusting. For us, completely agnostic to that. But layer zero is this structure for defining that layer of trust. And rather than at a systemic level, it's done at an asset level. So if there is an asset that sets bad risk parameters, that is hacked, and they chose, they did something malicious or something happened, only that asset is affected. All the other applications, all the other assets, they don't blink an eye. They never see it. They never think about it. It does not affect them in any way, shape, or form. There's no systemic form of risk in it.
So then that also sounds like a lot of work to set up. As in, for every individual kind of issuer, they have to decide how much security they have, what chains they're going to connect to. And Simon, is that your job to basically say, hey, you have this you need to do, I'm going to help you set it up so it all works? I mean, you talk about all this work you do on behalf of clients. What does that actually look like?
Yeah, well, I think Brian alluded to earlier that it's easy and there's a lot of inbound. It's not easy, otherwise I wouldn't have a job. But I think some of the biggest customers that we service, and Brian mentioned a few of them, be that PayPal or Paxos or the state of Wyoming or Ondo Finance, and the list kind of goes on and on and on, in terms of be that stablecoin issuers, be that RWA issuers, tokenized equities, like basically anything that's getting tokenized needs this technology. But the way that, you know, Brian and team have built this framework is it's very modular, it's very configurable, it's very customizable, which then allows for that customer or asset issuer to configure it, Brett, to your point, the way that they need it to meet their requirements. It's not complicated though, right? The foundational pieces are there, and you twist as many knobs as you want, or you kind of, you know, go to sort of default scenarios that are obviously, you know, recommended or kind of in market already. So I think that's kind of the beauty of this whole thing is, you know, to the extent that you want to own the security, to the extent that you want to turn each and every single knob from block confirmations to gas optimization, etc., you can absolutely do that. And my team, and you know, that services our biggest customers, especially institutions, et cetera, they want to have as much control as possible. But if you want to just sort of use the thing, you can just use the thing, right? And you can sort of configure the smart contracts, wire things up according to, you know, the instruction manuals and documentations that we built, and you click go.
One part I didn't mention about our prior life, me and my co-founders, we met in college, and we're working at an interoperability laboratory for early emergent IEEE technologies, so early versions of standardization for internet technologies, and that has really carried through. So we have created a standard around this. OFT is the Omnichain Fungible Token. That is, you know, that has been used for well over $100 billion of transfer. That is the standard that is used by almost every asset issuer, and there are still some knobs to turn, but the standardization of here's how you will do this for most assets has been established, and it's really accelerated the industry a lot. So there is some of that standardization, which helps any emergent or developing industry.
And the economics to you, percent of or what?
Not percent of, which I sort of joke that everyone congratulates me on. You know, we had a single $550 million and $800 million transfer go across. And two things, you know, one thing was very interesting is that we had no idea who was doing it at the time. So like, you know, you're just seeing the network getting these really almost billion-dollar transfers going across its thing that you built. The second, as I, you know, I say, I cry a little bit because we're not taking underlying bips, which is, but I mean, it's part of the attractive part overall
part
to the
asset
issuers themselves. It's like, to us, everything is an underlying packet. To us, there is, you know, we have Stargate, which we have a front end and sort of consumer facing side that, you know, has done over pushing $120 billion in volume now, I think lifetime, like by far the most application side of bridging. So we do have parts of the stack that we do get sort of flow and percentage-based BIPs on and some AUM side. But the core layer zero protocol, it doesn't matter whether you're sending a dollar or whether you're updating the state of your application or whether you're, you know, doing anything, any form of tokenization, whether you're moving $1 billion, it's just bytes. Just the way that us talking now is not any different than us sending financial data over the internet or us doing anything else. It's arbitrary bytes into the protocol itself. It's all just a message. And so we work closely with partners where sometimes we do develop this relationship, but at the core technology level, it's all just bytes.
And are you an enabler? I mean, we get asked questions all the time about the convergence between blockchain technology and AI. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, your role and where you think it's going?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this has always been one of the most interesting parts of the AI side is what does a world of fully autonomous agents look like where all of them need to co-negotiate for goods, right? So you have a bunch of fine-tuned models who are great at booking travel or doing X or Y or Z, you know, Shopify is launching these, I'm embedding these, happening all over the world. And I need to go and my agent needs to negotiate and use some of your compute and then get something out of it, right? There's this relationship that happens. So what does that exchange look like? And the technology is just so clearly built for micro payments and transactions and for sort of this underlying structure. And so for us, again, it is that world where if this happens on multiple environments, if you might want to do something in a financial instrument that is on Solana or Ethereum or Polygon or Robinhood Chain or any of these other things, the underlying agent itself is going to need to treat those things as a, it's not going to hold gas on 150 different chains. It's not going to, you know, go through this process of it's, the whole thing is going to be seamless. And that's sort of the structure that we built and most of the tooling that we built. So a lot of these things that are being built, if they're touching multiple chains, if you want the agent itself to be agnostic to where it is transacting, it will require either layer zero or a solution very much like layer zero.
And is the leveraged in kind of the model from the layer zero perspective, you say it's by, like if I were to look at a KPI and be like, hey, what is the most correlated thing with revenue to layer zero here? Would it be number of bytes going across your network? Would that be like, and basically, so like if you have more complex transactions, if you just have more activity, there is leverage there. It's just, you don't care if it's $1 million or a dollar that's transferring. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah. So again, there's the business has early on, like, you ask A16Z, you ask Sequoia when they were, you know, they co-led both of our last two rounds. And there was, go back 20 years in time, reinvent TCP/IP and take a small fee on every message ever sent across the internet, right? So at scale, in a world where every application is, you know, or many of the financial applications are transacting like this, you have a huge abundance of volume and messaging that are moving and data just moving across these networks. Absolutely, yes. That had always been the vision. What has happened is, the acceleration of stablecoins and some of this other stuff, tokenization, has just moved way faster than the underlying core data that other parts of the business, if you look from pure revenue side, it's probably more on the it's more on the flow-based side. It's more on the AUM-driven. It's more on the other sides of the business. While everything is sort of slowly ramping up and right, the jump from, you know, zero to $38 billion a month is very different than like zero to, you know, 40, 50,000 messages a day, which again is trending up and you're seeing it. But I would say dollars across the network is probably the single best indicator of overall adoption, everything else.
Right. But, and partly that's because if I'm transferring $1 million, I would just tolerate like more of a fee than if I'm transferring a dollar. But to Kathy's question, once AI systems are kind of like moving lots of information across, it could be that you have a much higher transaction communication signaling than you have dollar values shifting through, right? Wouldn't that be the way? Yeah.
Much, much, much. Yes, 100%.
Who's actively, I mean, it seems as though the agentic world is starting to move pretty quickly. Who's most active in that regard on your networks?
Yeah, so Simon can talk about, we just did an X402 POC a little while ago, and he can talk about some of the things he's been seeing actively more from the institutional side. Yeah,
I think, the agentic commerce framework that that I think is getting more and more popular, and X402 initiated payments is, you know, Coinbase has been pushing this pretty hard. There's a lot of financial institutions, Google, my alma mater is also joining that entire framework. So I think there's a lot happening that will continue to happen. We did a proof of concept with a very large financial institution out of Spain on some of this to see how we can, you know, initiate basically HTTPS based payments cross chain. Right. And so, you know, we're seeing that there was I'd say maybe what 12 to 18 months ago, maybe quite the boom on like crypto and AI, right? There's all these like agents that were popping up, right? Things like virtuals or AI 16Z at the time, right? And then there was a lot happening. Trades were getting initiated, you know, cross chain, et cetera, you know, via these agents. I think that has seemed to have calm down for now in terms of maybe the fad, but there's certainly something there from a technology perspective, right? And I think we'll see more of that kind of come back in the future for the right use cases.
Yeah, I would expect that. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with, there's this vending machine benchmark where they have the agents.
Oh yeah.
Basically, the agentic systems try to manage a vending machine and like a real world vending machine where it can order in goods and stuff, and the users intentionally try to dupe it and convince it to like put a Cybertruck on sale for a dollar and do stuff that, like, you know, in an adversarial environment, I think these systems are not quite ready. You can imagine a future state in which they're going to be self-executing and going to be like, you know, voracious great white sharks amongst a bunch of human fish. But right now, I think they're more like doofusy dodo birds that are going to get knocked over the head if they're set loose in the wild. And so I think we will cross a threshold where something will be like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I don't think we're there yet. And so I would, it's good that the underlying infrastructure is being designed for it. And I think there will be some threshold we need to cross before kind of non-dodo birds enter the environment to win against us.
Yeah, you mentioned stablecoins being a big surprise. Is that right? What do you think is happening there?
I talk a lot recently about this graph that I saw that I found fascinating. It was a graph on the historical mobility of money in globalization. What you saw was kind of the mid-1800s until the early 1900s, globalization was just up and right, the mobility of the dollar, or just currency itself. And you had all these articles in the early 1900s of like, globalization has solved war, like, you know, trade has secured everything. And then like 1914 happens and it just like drops like a rock, and it takes almost 80 years to recover into like the mid-1980s. And now we're sort of at all-time highs for globalization, and you have tariffs and everything that are happening in the world right now. And people saying globalization has topped again, and it's going to continue to go down. But I think it has come fascinating that the majority of that mobility of dollars was trade driven, and it was policy driven, and it was from countries sort of top down. And what you have seen, and again, I think Tether is just like the most canonical example of, is Tether. If you look at they built this incredible usage. They just talked about, you know, 500 million users in like unbanked countries, right? They're in Egypt and Nigeria and Argentina and El Salvador and like all of these markets that, you know, Turkey, all these markets that have underlying currencies that are really suffering, and all of the adoption is coming from the bottoms up, right? This is not who's being tariffed and what trade looks like and all of this. It is, if you have access to a smartphone and the internet, you now have access to US dollars and you have access to financial instruments that you never did before. And that arguably a lot of these countries would prefer you not have if you're escaping your underlying local currency, right? And I think that trend of what is happening of global permissionless markets and really what that sort of is doing overall is one of the most interesting economic trends that is that in the world is this transition from very heavily top-down driven to really bottoms-up driven, and again, just global permissionless markets. And so to me,
It seems, I agree with you. We are watching, you know, Gen Z around the world leading protests. You know, Madagascar, they overthrew the government. You know, they're seeing on the internet, you know, the lives they want and that they were promised, and yet they're seeing devaluations and inflation and, you know, really horrible living conditions. And I do think there is that revolt coming from the bottom up. We've talked about it quite a few times, Brett, right? On Brainstorm, trying to figure this out. And this is a manifestation of it. It is the stablecoin explosion here. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the world would prefer, with no barriers, the world would prefer probably a single money, like a single unit of account, you know? And so it's kind of, I mean, I do think monies are a winner-take-most game. And, you know, and kind of like there's a reason that sovereigns try to do capital controls and they have banking monopolies. And, you know, there's a lot of power in being able to control money. And so it imposes a lot of friction because people are like, this is not something that I, the person who am like collecting a VIG off of every dollar that goes through my economy, prefer. And we have seemed to cross a threshold where, hey, these global monies are available. And then everybody becomes US dollar dependent. So we need insurance against US dollars. So then that's why we need Bitcoin. And so that's there kind of go. Like the staged adoption here.
Well, we actually, in the early days of our holding Bitcoin, we started ARK in 2014 and bought Bitcoin in 2015. And I remember our conversations back then. We had just been through the European sovereign debt crisis. And so it was kind of top of mind. And we were thinking, okay, Bitcoin is going to be the reason emerging market currencies, you know, topple. And we were wrong on that. We're wrong. It's probably stable coins, right? And just, are these protests, are we at sort of a turning point here, you know, because stablecoin, the growth rate has been exceptional recently.
How would you see it happen on layer zero if that were the case?
Yeah.
What would happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think
for you?
I think we're already seeing it happen. In that, and there's a stat that's kind of commonly thrown around that 60% of all stablecoins that exist, not even if you count by AUM or dollars in circulation, then it's higher. But 60% of all stablecoins that exist are built on layer zero, and there was just a really I love competitive environments because competitive environments sort of bring out the absolute truth in most things. And so you have, you know, a bunch of people, they're all a lot of venture capitalists. A lot of them have their darling portcos that may be competitive or trying to break into the space. And they're, you know, preaching sort of that. There was Hyperliquid, which is incredible, you know, doing $1.5 billion a year right now and growing super quickly. They had this sort of call for USDH, for the native Hyperliquid stablecoin. And there were almost 10 proposals that were put up, and every single one of them chose to use layer zero. Every single one of them said, this partner, built on layer zero. And there was a tweet that went around from a fund who actually I quite respect. I really liked them as a fund. They had led, you know, we never got to work with them because they had led the round in a competitor early on. And even, you know, this tweet that went out was like, here's why we chose everything. And like layer zero is clearly the best interop, right? So I think when it comes to stablecoins, when it comes to this side of things, we've sort of, the industry has coalesced and this is now sort of the canonical way to do things. I think that's an incredibly privileged position to be in for us. But I think it really has shown more and more that new stablecoins that are launching, certainly those that are getting scale, there has just become this embedded network effect that when layer zero comes to an ecosystem, now you have sort of all of these premium assets, all of these really large names you now have sort of the ability to have there. That's a huge empowering effect for the underlying chain itself, but also the stablecoins themselves. So I sort of want to be folded into that mesh. And the standardization has helped some. It's listed on every major exchange. It's been used by market makers sort of in their back-end flows for their rebalance inventory. All of these things have accelerated where like it's just much less friction as an option. But I think the world, again, but more stable coins, very good for layer zero.
Well, yes. And so, you know, we have thought that, you know, stable coins would submit to the network effect as well. Could layer zero be the reason that's not true? Meaning, winner take most, Tether and Circle right now have 85%. And actually, we watch the shares pretty carefully, and just very short term, they seem to have stabilized somewhat. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting because there's two sides of that network effect that are really being tackled right now, as I view it. And one of them is the embedded network effect of how are assets paired on chain, right? How is it, you know, X versus USDC, or is it X versus USDT? And what is the most common route on every new chain? And when a chain is launching, or sort of what are the canonical pairings of all the other assets against for stable coins? What is the thing that's being held there? So that is like one side of demand is within crypto's current environment. But the other side of demand is really, and this is where, you know, Tempo, Stripe, Bridge are competing in. This is where Circle has pushed a lot. This is where Tether has really had this amazing network effect long-term of really how ingrained it is and how easy it is to use in a bunch of these emerging markets or in a traditional banking system or anywhere. How can I get out of the stablecoin and pay a merchant and move from T+2 to T+0 settlement or have the merchant have this immediate remediation? How do you make some of this stuff sort of completely abstracted away in the back end? I think that side has always been very interesting because it doesn't touch, it's not code, right? It's a merchant, it's real world adoption. It's there was just a big announcement of Western Union and the fact that Western Union has these, you know, 500,000 relationships directly to the merchant and what that actually like they're considering a stablecoin now. And that is sort of the competitive edge that they're looking at. And so I do think this network effect is being tackled from both sides. And I think if you really want long-term adoption, you have to have both sides of it. So I think we play a piece. I think we're very much looking to build more in the stack of how do we just enable that or help our partners like build to that side. We want the stablecoin to be as useful a tool as humanly possible, because what we've seen is more usage for stables is more usage for layer zero. And so we're constantly building things sort of around that world, but I do think it's a two-sided problem.
And you don't think there will be just a few big winners?
I think there is such a strong incentive right now that it is natural. We have, you know, again, Tether is like the best business. It's like $16 billion net profit on like a 100-person headcount. And like everybody's looking at this business and going, oh my God, like, of course, there's a million stable coins that are coming up to try to do this because the business model right now is incredible. And so like naturally, I think we see that really wide gap. So it's hard to imagine that that's going to lessen anytime soon. Maybe if rates come down, maybe if the world gets more competitive around needing to give out rates on something, you know, there's a bunch of different levers there that make the business maybe less attractive to the net newcomer. I think there's certainly a world, like Brett said, the world probably wants a single unit of account or a single currency, doesn't want 100 different stable coins, right? I think there are these embedded network effects.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I think it largely depends too on who's actually driving that distribution, right? Because there's the stablecoin issuer that's driving the distribution. There's the chain that's driving the distribution in some cases. There's the application that's driving the distribution, right? And all of that. So if you look at, you know, examples of that, you know, some chains are very universal, let's say geographically. Other chains, for example, are very focused on like emerging markets. Like if you look at Stellar, for example, they're very popular in like Africa and South America, right? Which means that then the applications that they invite to be built on their chain will be sort of locally focused, and there will be wallets and applications for those specific regions, which means then they will, you know, need a Stellar specific asset. And maybe that is, you know, something that USDT and the Tether expands to, or maybe that is something completely different. Like in Stellar's case, it's PYUSD that they're really pushing sort of within that market, right? So I think, and then it also kind of is analogous to, I think, who are the, like the biggest payment providers, let's say like sans crypto in the world, right? Like, let's say PayPal, Venmo sort of have the US market. Revolut has a lot of the European market. Pix has a lot of the South America market. Let's say something like Alipay has you know, a decent amount of Asia, et cetera. And so I think it ultimately that comes down to who's going to drive all the distribution. And most of these stablecoin issuers are you know, are probably not yet big enough to drive like absolute global distribution everywhere. Right. And so it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out.
The U.S. population is, what, 5% of global, and we're 25% of global GDP, but 50% of language online is English. And I think, like, language is also a natural monopoly network effect type thing. And if anything, money should be more so, where it's kind of like, you know, eliminate all the rules. We would all settle on one unit of account. You know, it probably wouldn't be acorns or cowrie shells, right? It would be something. And so I just think there's like so many kind of like small defrictionings if we're all agreeing that a dollar is a dollar or a tether is a tether. And like to your point, if on Stellar, Tether wants to launch into that, then that would, layer zero would facilitate kind of essentially that bridging function. So it could be that layer zero also serves as a mechanism by which you can have one stablecoin rather than having a proliferation, but remains to be seen. Okay, last question. Brian, if you could choose, would you, this is from a layer zero perspective, would you choose to have like every underlying dollar be on stablecoins, like the entire economy is on stablecoins, or all of the real world traditional financial assets getting tokenized, or a, you know, sea of AI agents running around doing all of these financial transactions? You get one of those three options. Which do you think is best for layer zero?
I think we've been focused on number one. So number one is my gut. I think rank ordered, it's probably number three is probably the best for layer zero, just because agents, again, are probably going to send 1,000, 10,000x more messages than most people will, right? And data starts growing all this. So probably agents is best for layer zero. And then stable coins, because naturally a stable coin is moving across these chains and environments much more. So the velocity is much higher than like a share of Apple, which like you buy and just sits for some period of time, right? And then it's tokenization. I do think we're pretty heavily focused on all three of them. But I think in terms of what is best for layer zero, it's 3-1-2.
Okay.
But they're all going to happen though. Yeah, they're going to converge to some extent right?
Yes.
You know, we have high frequency traders in the financial world, and AI is only going to stimulate that. So,
well, thank you much. Exponential growth. I think look forward to all three of those futures and Layer Zero facilitating it all. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Brian and Simon. And Kathy,
thank you.
Always
oh,
a pleasure
thank you, Brett.
To talk with you. All right.
I'm thrilled to be here.
ARC believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARC. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.